Good morning. Welcome to Mountain Money. It is Monday, April 14th, and today we're talking about tariffs. We're joined by Elena Patel from the University of Utah. Give us an overview, a high-level overview of tariffs, and then let's look closer to home and chat with Rory Murphy to see how tariffs can affect you right next door. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
To say that the last 10 days have been confusing with respect to the trading relationships between the United States and the rest of the world would certainly be an understatement. The tariff announcement from the White House on April 2nd sent shockwaves around the world and sent world markets tumbling. Then an April 9th posting on Truth Social by the president that postponed the effectiveness of certain tariffs for 90 days sent the markets soaring. But the next morning, the markets were down again. And by midday on the 10th, the market had entered a sharp decline. Welcome to whiplash. So what are the underlying principles with respect to how tariffs affect international trade? What has been the experience of the United States and other countries when high tariffs have been applied in the past? We're lucky to be joined this morning by Professor Elena Patel of the University of Utah School of Business, who has studied the economics of trade and tariffs. I should note that this interview is being recorded on April 10th, and it is certainly possible that things will have changed by the time it is aired. Welcome to Mountain Money, Elena.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks for being here. Well, let's start with an excerpt from the Tariffs 101 class that one might take. What is a tariff and what are the general economic effects of implementing one?
Yep, that's a really good question. So a tariff is a tax. That's the easiest place to start. And it's a tax on imports. So any country can impose a tariff on the goods that are coming into its borders. When you're trying to understand the effects of a tariff and how we think about them, you really want to keep in mind sort of the global market. In the global market, you know, businesses can sell their products subject to free trade agreements pretty flexibly anywhere. And so the price of their products we think of as being the same no matter where they're sold. So when we put a tax on imports, what we're doing is changing the price of the good in the United States only and causing some deviation from the price that could be sold in another country. So it's good to have like a concrete example. You could think about wine.
Why
right?
Not?
We might want to import a bottle of wine from France. Maybe the bottle of wine from the French, you know, vineyard could be sold anywhere in the world for $10. When, you know, Utah, for example, DABS is bringing in French wine to sell in our stores, they're going to import from the French producer. The French producer is going to sell it to us for $10. And then DABS is going to have to pay a tax when it comes into the border. And the tax is, you know, the subject of much consternation at the state and federal level these days, what that tax is going to be. But ultimately, what I think people need to keep in mind is that that $10 bottle of wine now costs more in the United States because DABS paid a tax when it brought it into the country. And really emphasizing it's DABS that pays the tax, not the French wine producer. And the French wine producer is really not generally incentivized to say, okay, DABS, I'll give you a lower price because you have to pay a tax. They don't do that. They could sell their bottle of wine somewhere else. And so then DABS, generally, when the wine shows up on the store shelves in Utah, it's going to cost more because it costs DABS more to bring the bottle of wine into the country.
So the French wine producer is just going to sell to whomever, and it's always going to be $10. Even if England has a 10% tariff and Germany has a 20%, they don't care.
Exactly. The French wine producer doesn't really care what the domestic tax rate is. That's how economists think about it. And what I would say is because we've seen, you know, changes in tariff rates over the last 100 years, there's lots of good evidence that suggests that it's not the French wine producer that changes its price. It's the U.S. importer of the good that's going to adjust the price.
Gotcha. Now, and eventually, since DABS pays the tax or tariff, then it gets passed on to the consumer.
Exactly. And almost with near full pass-through. If there's a $1 tax, the price is going to go up by a dollar when you try to buy it in DABS stores.
And that's not just speculation. I take it that's what you've seen in terms of looking at historical examples.
Yes, exactly. And especially since 2019, when the first Trump administration started tinkering with tariffs in a way that was pretty substantial departure from previous U.S. tariff policy. There's, again, evidence that those targeted tariffs led to near full price increases in the products that were affected by the tariffs.
So we talked about, let's just dig a little bit into the economics. Okay, why would I do this? What is the purpose of a tariff to raise money? Is the purpose of a tariff to support domestic industries? Talk a little bit about what policy objectives regulators usually think of when they're talking about implementing tariffs.
Yeah, I mean, I would say yes to everything you said, but with big asterisks to understand the practical implications of those questions. So, for example, one question might want to ask is, we have big federal deficits right now. We need more revenue. Why isn't a tariff a great place to try to get revenue? What I will try to highlight is that you sort of can't have it both ways with tariffs if we're using them to protect domestic industries. So either the tariff raises revenue because U.S. producers do not change their supply chains or onshore any production. They just continue to import the exact same amount of goods and they pay a tax. So that's not protecting any industries. That's simply raising the price of imports and may result in some revenue. Or on the flip side, you set a very low tariff so that it doesn't really affect trade flows, and then it can generate some revenue. But it can't be both of those things at the same time. So that's step one is, yes, there's probably some revenue to be raised by imposing tariffs. And I think there's a range of estimates out there right now from various think tanks and academics that's maybe on the order of $100 billion to $200 billion a year, which is not a small amount of money. It just unfortunately is a drop in the bucket when you talk about federal spending and the federal budget. So that's kind of the question around revenue. There's a possibility, but it depends on what you're trying to achieve when you impose the tariff. And if the point is to protect domestic industries and to incentivize firms to onshore production to avoid the tariff, you're sort of baking in that you assume there'll be very little revenue associated with the tax itself. So I think that was the first question you asked.
Because what will happen, I take it, is that the domestic industry that you're trying to facilitate is going to charge a price that's only slightly less than
Correct.
What the imported
Yep.
price is. So consumers are going to pay more no matter what. And
exactly.
I guess the other thing about it is that we heard a lot of talk in the news, and we'll get to this a little further, about how this is going to create an incentive to build more factories. I guess I would think that for that to happen, there would have to be a high degree of certainty that that structure was
exactly.
going to be in place long enough for me to build a factory. Am I thinking about
I
that
think
right?
You've touched on exactly, I think, the concern for most economists. And I think most policymakers, if they're being honest when they think about the effects of the policies that are being proposed right now, the executive branch is kind of relying on a temporary ability to impose tariffs that comes through trade acts. But ultimately, the executive branch doesn't have the authority to impose taxes. That authority lies with Congress. And so there's a great deal of uncertainty right now in a couple of lanes. One, the administration has invoked emergency economic powers to threaten some of these tariffs. And I think there are serious legal questions about whether that's possible. And there's even a bipartisan effort in Congress to kind of undo the declaration of emergency, which would erase the tariffs. The second is the trade acts that the administration is relying on to impose certain tariffs, which they used in the first administration and the Biden administration sort of re-upped. Those are meant to be very temporary in nature. The executive branch doesn't really have the authority to permanently change the tariff system in the United States. Only Congress has that. And so everybody should be thinking about these tariffs as temporary. How long is temporary, I think, is anybody's guess. But if I were a business, the truth is it's more expensive to produce things in the United States. And free trade has allowed the entire globe to take advantage of something called comparative advantage, which is who can produce something for the least opportunity cost. And everybody wins when we let production happen in a specialized way. So kind of with that in mind, it's efficient to produce certain things outside of the United States. And Americans would be worse off, truthfully, if we try to do everything domestically. And most importantly, these supply chains are very entrenched. We learned that during the pandemic that, you know, American businesses and also French businesses and Chinese businesses, they have set up their supply chains in a way that don't move very easily. So suppose the administration achieved its goal and incentivized businesses to onshore car production. That is not going to happen on the scale of 1 to 2 to 3 years even. It's going to happen beyond this administration when maybe the next party comes in or a new Republican president comes in that suddenly with the stroke of a pen can undo these things. So for me, it's very hard to imagine that a business would respond to the current uncertain environment, especially when imposed through the executive branch's authority, by shifting supply chains in a way that results in more costly production.
So now this is, the tariffs are there because there's a belief that we have a trade deficit.
Right.
And is a trade deficit bad?
That's a very good question. So it is a fact that we have a trade deficit. We've had a trade deficit since the mid-1970s, so this is nothing new. And a trade deficit is just a measure of the amount of our exports compared to the amount of our imports. So it's really not anything more than some economic measure that's reflecting sort of trade flows across the border. And trade deficits do not need to be bad. In fact, in most instances, they're not bad. They're just a reflection of, again, the relative efficiency of production across borders that might have something to do with the tax system. It might have something to do with infrastructure and, you know, human capital. There's lots of things about different locations for production that lead to trade deficits. There are certain elements of trade deficits that are important to keep in mind and might warrant temporary tariffs. That's why these sort of temporary trade acts exist for the executive branch. When we think we're having a trade deficit in the U.S. in certain industries or for certain products because of unfair trade practices or unsustainable borrowing, or in a real situation, which I do not believe is a situation we're in right now, there can be national security concerns that might warrant expanding domestic production in a particular product or a particular supply chain to protect U.S. security interests. Those are reasons why we might be concerned about a small part of the trade deficit that relates perhaps to a particular product. But aggregate trade deficits are not bad or good, just like aggregate trade surpluses are not bad or good. And sort of economists think that, you know, over the lifetime, I mean, not our lifetime, truthfully, like hundreds and hundreds of years, these things have to come into balance because they actually reflect sort of deficits and surpluses in terms of capital flows that eventually must come into balance. And so we have been in a trade deficit for, you know, more than 50 years. Maybe at some point we'll come out of it, but I don't see anything about the situation except for maybe particular products again, and there can be some justification for certain limited tariffs, why the situation that we're in is quote unquote bad. It's just a reflection of the supply and demand across the globe.
Gotcha. So you use the word products a couple of times. Is the trade deficit just on goods or goods and services?
We have a trade deficit in goods and a trade surplus in services. And so where we're going to get hit right now, I believe that's true. I have to double check the St. Louis Fed. But where the expectation is that U.S. Producers will be hit is in U.S. services. And that's actually a lot of the chatter in Europe, for example, is that the tariffs will land on U.S. surplus or U.S. services abroad.
Well, I want to get to the April 2nd presentation of reciprocal tariffs, but before we do, let's talk a little bit about the words trade war are being bandied about now.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about a historical perspective. When have policymakers tried high tariffs in the past, and how did it work out?
Yeah, so this is a fun thing to talk about because we don't actually have that many examples, but the examples we have, the U.S. has ended up with egg on its face almost every single time. And so the thing people talk about a lot right now is the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act that happened during the Great Depression. That the sort of political rhetoric around the current implementation of tariffs unfortunately echoes what happened in the 1930s, which was, you know, we were in the middle of the Great Depression. Politicians were trying to protect American farmers and manufacturers, and so they imposed very large tariffs on more than 20,000 goods. And that sparked a trade war. And so that did not cause the Great Depression, to be clear, but most economists and historians think that the Great Depression deepened and lasted longer because of this trade war, and eventually this was shut off. The ability to do this was shut off, and there were a whole bunch of new trade acts that came out of sort of the failure of the Smoot-Hawley tariffs of the 1930s. The other one people like to talk about are the chicken tariff wars, maybe because they have a funny name, but also because the historical context is really important. This was in the 1960s. Now the European Union, but then just sort of European, you know, states imposed tariffs on U.S. chicken exports. So they were trying to reduce European consumption of American chicken. I will say that the historical evidence is that the, you know, administration in Washington, D.C. tried to negotiate out of these tariffs, but eventually, sort of after a year of unsuccessful negotiations, the U.S. retaliated with tariffs of our own that were sort of equal value on light trucks, brandy, and potato starch. And so when we do these things, we tend to find products that we think directly affect our trading partners and are of roughly equal value. The light truck piece of this is the piece people tend to focus on. You may have noticed, or consumers notice, that most light trucks are made in the United States. It's not an accident. It's in part because the import of light trucks from other places is subject to a 25% tariff. So it's kind of protected that industry, but in a way that's harmful because as we're moving out of sort of high gasoline consumption vehicles, American truck manufacturers have never really had to compete with European and Japanese and Chinese manufacturers. And so our technology, especially in that particular class of vehicles, has lagged because we haven't had to compete. And also American producers, I think, have a smaller presence on the global stage because of the focus on light trucks in the United States. And then there's this like funny story about what qualifies as a light truck. It's truthfully, you can put as many regulations as you want around tariffs, and businesses are always smarter than the lawyers. They figure out how to get around it. And so things that eventually become light trucks in the U.S., shipped to the U.S., for example, with superfluous seats bolted to the truck bed, which makes it not a light truck anymore. Then it arrives in the U.S., the car producer or manufacturer takes the seats off and sells it as a light truck in the U.S., and it's bypassed the tariff. And Sprinter vans, for example, they arrive in the U.S. Not assembled so that they avoid that tariff. Then we put them together and we sell them in the U.S. And so lots of these games happen, not just in the car industry and the truck industry, to avoid tariffs. That's why we think these tariffs are actually really hard to collect, because consumers and producers are what economists call highly elastic, which is very sensitive to price changes. And so if you can move a supply chain and kind of route it through Mexico or a country for whom we have good trading contracts with, or if you can change the product just a little bit to avoid the characterization and then change it back when it gets to the United States, you avoid the tariff completely.
No, going with that, can't China send stuff through Malaysia or Indonesia and then get it into this country to avoid the insane tax?
So I think on paper, the answer is no. Again, the IRS and customs tries to impose rules to make sure that like there's a substantial character of the product has to be modified at a different part in the supply chain to not be a Chinese import, for example. However, we know, again, that the businesses are more clever than the IRS and customs can possibly write regulations around. So the truth is, we think that the Chinese tariffs from 2018 and again sort of re-upped under the Biden administration were less effective than they might have seemed on paper, because affected countries like China find a way to route things through other lanes to avoid the tariffs to begin with.
So with that, can you explain the math behind, we had this outside press conference and there was this chart and there were a bunch of things labeled as reciprocal tariffs on the April 2nd presentation. What were they really doing, and how does that fit in terms of historical trade protection measures?
Yeah, that's a really good idea to talk about that, because I want to start by saying there is a definition of a reciprocal tariff that's quite sensible. It's exactly what you think it is. If the EU imposes a 1% tariff on a product that the US is exporting to the EU, then the US responds by either imposing the same 1% tariff on EU imports, or they pick other products that and a tariff rate that results in an equal value of affected goods. And reciprocal tariffs happen in response to sort of unexpected tariff imposition with our trading partners, with whom we have usually very good trade relations, but every once in a while something goes a little funny. And the US Trade Representative will get involved and figure out the size and scope of the damages and propose, you know, reciprocal tariffs of equal value. So that's what a reciprocal tariff is. What the administration showed on their sort of poster board during Liberation Day in that press conference was not a reciprocal tariff. What they claimed that they were doing was trying to get a measure of all of the trade barriers faced by U.S. businesses in some kind of rate, and then impose a reciprocal tax or tariff that equaled the rate that they calculated these unfair trade barriers to be. But they used a formula that, again, left economists scratching our heads, and something that does not reflect trade barriers at all, which is the trade deficit, like we talked about, divided by the value of imports. And then they said, we're being nice, so we'll take 50% of that. So if you take China, for example, the trade deficit with China is about $300 billion. And we import from China like $400 billion in goods. So you stack those on top of each other. And they claim that China imposes a 67% tariff on U.S. goods, which is not true. And then they say, okay, we're nice, we'll divide it by half, we're going to impose a 34% reciprocal tariff. And the place where this is like the easiest to see as being a somewhat crazy definition of a reciprocal tariff is the EU, which on that poster board, I think the EU was labeled as imposing a 37% tariff on U.S. goods, when it's something like 1% to 2%. The actual tariff rate on U.S. goods is something like 1% to 2%. So you can imagine why our trading partners probably all threw their hands in the air because in some sense, if it's a thing you're trying to correct, you can't even correct the measure that's being proposed as a trade barrier by lowering tariffs. It's not possible.
And some of those levels of some of those tariffs, and I think Vietnam was over 50%.
Yeah.
Where do those levels fit in terms of historical trade protection?
The levels are a historic shock, actually. So again, like from a trade protection standpoint, we have had historically very low tariffs since there was a constitutional amendment in the early 1900s, like 1907, to allow the federal government to tax income. So, you know, at the start of the U.S. as a country and through the 1800s, tariffs were a major source of revenue. We were a small country. We didn't have a lot of revenue needs. And also, it wasn't the federal government was not legally allowed to tax income. And so once the constitutional amendment came and allowed income to be a base for the federal tax, tariffs went away as a major source of revenue. And they've been less than 1% roughly since 1907, with a couple of spikes here and there that are associated with these trade wars that we talk about that are very short-lived. And so the rates that have been proposed and now paused on April 2nd are like shocking in the context of the U.S. sort of tariff and trade history.
And what would be the effect if they went into place in terms of some of the, you know, sort of consumer products and consumer impacts?
Yeah, my sense is, I mean, if we were allowed to shift rate to equilibrium, the price level is going to increase. And so the question is, how long is it going to take for that to happen, for things to be more expensive for consumers and more expensive for businesses to produce? That kind of depends on what's already like onshore. For things that are consumed almost as quickly as they're brought in the border, this like groceries and things that are not very durable, the prices should go up almost immediately. When you're talking about more complicated supply chains and cars, for example, there are estimates that the price of cars is going to go up substantially. But when that happened kind of depends on what's on the lot, what's coming in on the shipping containers, and sort of once we eat through everything that's in the United States, everything that is imported will start to go up. And the assumption is, because we've seen this in the past, one for one with the value of the tariff that's imposed on the good.
Now, going off on cars, I understand a lot of vehicles are manufactured, you know, they're U.S. manufactured vehicles, but they cross the border into Canada back and forth a few times for different parts.
Yeah.
Are they getting tariffed each time they cross the border by both sides?
So a car is a great example of something that I think the statistic is, on average, for the final production of a car, the parts have crossed the border 8 times. And the truth is that the true interpretation of what's been proposed, now there's no legislative language allowed around it or regulatory language. And so unfortunately, all we have to go off of are some tweets and also executive orders that are very loose in their specification. But taking the idea as given, that's in some sense why the expected price of a car would rise so much, is because every time these parts come across the border, they get hit with a tariff. Now, what's happened is, you know, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement is a renegotiation of a long-standing free trade agreement between Mexico, the United States, and Canada in order to allow all three countries to take advantage of specialization and make everybody better off. And so for now, things that are compliant with the USMCA agreement, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement, they are currently exempt. Although, as you said, when this airs, I don't know what the state of those products will be, because these things fluctuate day by day in a way that, for somebody like me who pays close attention, it's very hard for me to keep a track of what's on, what's off, what's on pause, what's maybe going to come into play. But what's been threatened is exactly that, that car supply chain with, in principle, tariffs at every stage of movement across the borders.
So we've heard that many countries are lining up to negotiate. I'm trying to figure out what that would look like. If you're Vietnam with a 50% tariff and you just want to sell us Nike shoes, what would that discussion be about?
I think this is the one where I scratch my head the most. I don't think the administration has been particularly clear in articulating what they're after, besides something that can't possibly be negotiated, which is reducing the trade deficit to zero or moving it to a surplus. Vietnam can't come to the U.S. and say, okay, we're going to change that and it's going to be a trade surplus now. That's an outcome of supply and demand in the market that is not negotiated between two countries. So you could imagine superficially, maybe Vietnam offers to lower some of the tariffs that are in place. Or again, in Europe, maybe they lower some of the tariffs. But again, their scope to do that is, on average, tariffs are 3%. And so you could imagine that if what you were after were headlines from negotiations, it might not sound like a win for Europe to say, we're going to reduce the tariff by 1 percentage point to 2%. And now this administration says, aha, do you see what I did? I got concessions. We'll take this off. And so I think without a clear articulation of the goal, or at least something that's been clearly articulated that is adjustable, so the trade deficit, again, is not adjustable by bilateral negotiations and tariff rates, I don't understand where a win comes from here. I think the flip side is what we're seeing, which is an escalation in the U.S.-China sort of deterioration of free trade agreements, where China is at 125% right now. We were the last actor to layer an extra tax. I would imagine sometime between now and when this airs, China is going to respond again with yet another tariff that's going to start layering on top. And that's what I suspect is going to be the outcome in most cases for any country with substantial U.S. imports.
So let's stay with China, because we have this tit-for-tat going on. The two largest economies in the world, you know, what does this movie look like? I mean, who has to blink an eye?
It's like the worst game of chicken I think I've ever been party to, unfortunately. So if we think about what is going to happen, truthfully, everybody is going to be hurt. There's going to be higher prices for U.S. consumers, for Chinese consumers. U.S. businesses and Chinese businesses are going to face lower demand. Supply chains will be disrupted in a way that could be quite critical, given the way that these two economies rely on each other for certain kinds of production. Exports are going to be lost in two major economies. This is going to have employment pressures. If you're a U.S. exporter exporting to China that is now imposing retaliatory tariffs, demand for your product just fell. So your ability to maintain employment in your factories, for example, is going to get shaky. And it's kind of a matter of how long this lasts, how long, you know, employers can hang on. And so it's the worst game of chicken where we're trying to see who's going to win the leverage race versus like endurance and ability to kind of just sit and take it until somebody blinks. And your guess is as good as mine how long that will take. But my sincere hope is that this de-escalates as quickly as possible, because really nobody wins from what's going on right now.
Nobody in the world will win on that.
Nobody in the world. It's not just the U.S. and China. Everybody is affected by this.
Now, China, I imagine if our tariffs are impacting their business, they're going to go and look for other nations that will buy their stuff, or possibly, since they're so close to Southeast Asia, maybe find manufacturing in Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, you know, something like that. Can China pull that off?
I mean, it remains to be seen. These are two large economies that have, longstanding relationships, although I think, unfortunately, we're in the process of own goal kicking on our foreign relationships with other countries as well. But longstanding relationships. And so whether and how businesses can pivot is kind of remains to be seen in a shakeout sense. But what I worry about, again, is if you think this is temporary, then really, as a business, you should just sit tight. You really should not be engaging in costly transitions.
So there's been a lot of talk about things like intellectual privacy on behalf of China and unfair practices. But the bottom line, I think, is that they produce a lot of cheap stuff and people in this country like to buy things that aren't expensive. Yeah. What is it that they could do that would... I'm struggling with what their negotiation looks like that gets to a resolution here.
Yeah, again, I sort of agree with you in that I don't know, because, again, it's not clear what the goal of this is. I don't think we're intending for the U.S. to start producing textiles. That's not what our comparative advantage is. It's not sort of what the productivity level of U.S. workers is. The reason why we have high wages in the U.S. is because our workers are comparatively more skilled, they're more productive, they have access to better infrastructure, better educational systems, and all of that is reflected in, like, differential wage rates. And we should be proud and happy of that. We don't want U.S. workers to be working at the same rates as sort of Chinese factory workers. And so, again, this is this notion of you can try to do everything yourself without using any foreign suppliers, but everybody in the U.S. will be worse off for doing that because it is more costly to produce those things, which is going to reduce our income level.
Sticking with China, so China, if they start losing manufacturing due to us not buying their products, the Chinese government has been known in the past to just hand out money, but we can't do that here in the U.S. for our workers.
Yep. So that's the part of this game of chicken is endurance. And unfortunately, there are real concerns about sort of unfair trade practices in China compared to the rest of the world. I don't think they're the biggest problem right now when you think about why China is producing so much, but I don't think it's terrible to try to take on sort of unfair subsidies. At the same time, we are doing the same thing. That's what the IRA did. The IRA, right, offered tax credits to protect domestic production of clean energy. And the idea was always for that to be temporary until domestic production of clean energy can get up over this cost curve and be competitive with China. But the reason why China is competitive in, for example, the production of clean energy is not really at this point because of Chinese subsidies. It's because Chinese businesses invested a lot in these products. And at this point, they've gotten up the cost curve. These things are very cheap. They're very good at producing these things. And all I see is the U.S. kind of losing the race and the ability to be part of a global market that will certainly involve sort of green and clean energy products going forward. We're just slipping behind. And so China, I think, might outlast us in terms of endurance, especially because of the fiscal situation the United States is in right now, which is running primary deficits chronically. And so our ability, for example, to subsidize affected businesses gets harder and harder each year because we aren't solving our federal budget situation at the same time. And China just is not in that situation. Chinese consumers and the Chinese government oversaves in some sense. They have a lot of capital sitting around to do this. U.S. consumers do the opposite, right? We sort of don't save enough. And so those like fiscal imbalances are part of this, which suggests that China probably has the weight behind it to outlast us, if that's really how this is going to happen.
So 20 years from now, when you're writing the retrospective about what happened during the first half of 2025, what are you going to say? Where will this end?
I wish I knew the answer to that. I think if you had asked me that in like 2018, when it was the first Trump administration, I think we had a better handle on all of the people that were involved in the administration and like the checks and balances that felt like they were in place to, you know, corral people who have out-of-the-box ideas, which is supposed to happen at all levels of leadership, right? Out-of-the-box ideas should be proposed. And in a room of, you know, I don't want to say the word grown-ups because that sounds too condescending, but in a room of people where we're all trying to achieve some stated goal, you balance out-of-the-box ideas with like what's allowable and what's practical and what makes sense. And what worries me right now, compared to 2018, which what happened in 2018 was the start of the U.S.-China trade war in some sense, the most recent iteration of this, but not broad-based, right? Very specific products that I think had their roots in unfair trade practices and protecting American industries that had national security pieces to them and following sort of normal channels and the use of trade acts, for example, to impose these tariffs. And I guess I would say is consistent with that is the Biden administration could have turned these things off and did not. And I think there's a question of whether they should or shouldn't, but like the justification for why the original round of tariffs, which were themselves historically high, were put in place on Chinese products, were rooted in unfair trade practices and national security concerns. What we're talking about now has nothing to do with that. And there are lots of ways that there could be checks and balances on what's going on. People involved in the administration, congressional checks and balances, voter checks and balances, and none of those yet have had time to come to fruition when you think about voters and voters voting with their feet in some sense and saying this is not what we want. And congressional checks and balances so far have not quite materialized. The Senate has, in a bipartisan way, passed some checks on the administration's ability to impose tariffs, revoking the national emergency between Canada and Mexico, for example. The House is unlikely to take it up. In fact, they've outmaneuvered the Senate to ensure that they will not take it up. And so we're missing these checks and balances in a way that makes it really hard for me to project forward what's going to happen. Whereas I think what happened in 2018 was maybe a little bit surprising, but also predictable if you understand the administration's ability to impose tariffs in regular order. So my hope is that, again, in a game of chicken, everybody diverts their bike, right, in the next week or two, and things de-escalate. I just don't know where the off-ramp's going to come from because it's been set up in a way that I don't see how the administration can clock a win. And this administration so far really would like to clock a headline win, and there isn't one to be had right now.
Many economists are now predicting that one of the results of all this, at least while we have this uncertainty, will be a reduction in GDP. Is that something that you agree with?
100%. I mean, how much I think is, you know, as good as anybody's macroeconomic model, which I think most people will tell you is more about the direction of the wind than it is the actual magnitude of the economic effect. But what we know is, and I think we're going to start to see in the data, but it's still going to take some time because economic data really lags real activity. But I think by midsummer, it's going to be apparent that businesses are holding off making decisions. They're holding off making decisions because they don't know what the business climate is. And consumers are nervous about a price increase from tariffs. And so on the one hand, we maybe saw a flurry of car purchases last month, right before the tariffs were going to come online. But that's just, you should think of as an acceleration. I was going to buy a car this summer, so I'm going to buy it now to avoid the tariff. But if consumers are nervous about the economy, they're going to spend less. Consumer sentiment is very important. And unfortunately, soft numbers about consumer sentiment shows it's tanking. Businesses are nervous. You see that in the markets. So that means that they were going to build a factory this year, or maybe not even something that extravagant. Maybe they were going to upgrade lines in their production processes. They're holding off right now because they're nervous about a recession. And the sort of analysts that we pay attention to in terms of recession forecasts, these things are all ticking up at a very fast clip. And so for right now, you can imagine why GDP is likely to slow. And if any of these things come to fruition, I think that history is not going to look kindly on this three-month period of taking an American economy that was kind of in all ways shockingly hot at the end of last year and tanking it, which is what it feels like is happening right now. Again, an own goal kick on a very hot U.S. economy.
We've been speaking with Professor Elena Patel, who ended this interview with a sports analogy.
Yes.
Thank you, Professor Patel. We appreciate the time. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome back. We just heard the big picture look at tariffs from Professor Elena Patel. It's possible that such a high-level view may not hit home with some listeners, so we're joined by longtime local builder-developer Rory Murphy to bring the tariff view to your neighborhood. Good morning and welcome to Mountain Money.
Good morning.
So did I get that right? You're a builder-developer?
That's correct.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And do you work just here in Park City? Are you also down in Camas Valley, Heber Valley, Salt Lake Valley at all?
I've done work in the Jordanelle, particularly in the early part of my career. I did a few developments out there. And then recently, the past few years, right up until Mr. Hastings purchased it, I worked at Powder Mountain and was in directing their real estate development there. And I've poked around here and there, but about 90% of what I've done is here in town.
And what are some of the other developments that people might be familiar with that you've been involved with, Rory?
Well, I think the one that most people know is Silver Star. The one that we just finished was King's Crown, and we're wrapping that up. Still little bits and pieces here and there. The Rio Grande building, but when I was with Hank Rothwell and with the United Park City Mines Company, Hank was the president, I was the vice president. We did, of course, what turned out to be Empire Pass, and which is, you know, a big flagship development that Talisker purchased. We privatized the company back in 2003. We were a publicly traded company, privatized it and sold it to Talisker. But we had most of the backbone of that project along and finished, and they, of course, did the vertical on it. And then the one I'm working on now is behind the Recycle Center, and that's the Engine House Affordable Housing Project, and that's going very well. We hope to be operating sometime around September of this year.
Well, do you have all your materials purchased for that project?
Fortunately, we do.
Perfect. So I imagine you're involved in the budgeting of projects, or at least privy to the budgeting.
Very involved.
Cool. So aside from labor, you have supplies ranging from lumber and nails to steel and heavy equipment. Do you expect an increase in materials costs due to tariffs?
I don't think there's a question you're going to see an increase in materials costs, particularly in the short term. And I mean the next, you know, 2 to 3 quarters anyway. And who knows? I mean, this whipsaw of you're under tariff, you're not under tariff, you're under tariff, you know, it sort of depends on the day of the week and the direction of the wind. And, I don't think anyone can track this at this point. But what everyone is going into this with is that currently Canadian lumber has a 14.5% tariff, has for years, okay, for several reasons, mostly stumpage fees in Canadian forests. But so with the new tariffs, you're going to get up somewhere around, it'll be about 34.5%. So you're essentially jacking it up to a third of the cost. Now, the United States gets 30% of their lumber, softwood lumber from Canada. We have two major producing areas, and that's the Northwest and the South. Now, the South is, they manage lumber there like a crop. So they have X number of production every year, and that's how it's managed. It's going in and cutting down this year's row of corn. And the South, pretty much, the markets there are confined to East Coast, the South, somewhat in lower Midwest. And, of course, for us over in Utah, California, and west of the Rockies, we get a lot of our lumber from the northwest United States. Now, the central U.S. is going to get hammered because they get almost all their lumber from Canada. And Canada, it's primarily two provinces. It's British Columbia and Alberta. And so what you're doing is you're saying, okay, fine, all your lumber now will cost 30% more.
And as a practical matter, if Canadian lumber costs 30% more, don't rational domestic suppliers raise their prices to just under that?
Well, you know, look, it's what the market will bear.
Right, right. Doesn't that change the market?
Of course it does. Okay. You know, I mean, if people think they can secure additional profit, then they're going to do it. It's, you know, what you can sell your commodity for and what a willing buyer will pay. And
also, it's interesting when you talk about it, I'm fascinated by the concept of managing lumber as a crop, because isn't it kind of like scotch? You had to have planted it in the barrel, you know, a number of years before. So they're probably supply constrained, right? They can only harvest so much lumber because there's only so many trees that they planted years before.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can dip into next year's supply.
A little bit.
Right. And, you know, because what will happen now is, well, a couple things are going to happen. One is your demand's going to spike because you have these commercial home builders that must have this continual supply of lumber. So what are they going to do? Well, they're going to stockpile it. I mean, that's what I think any business would do, so they can at least lock down what their costs are. What that will do is cause dramatic spikes in availability and supply. And as scarcity increases, you're going to see lumber go through the roof. And you got to understand that it's not just the price of the lumber. I mean, as far as a practical application to building a house or anything else, you know, you got a 30% increase on lumber. Well, you have the ancillary costs of the subcontractor will always mark that up. You know, they throw their 10% on. Then the contractor, who is just, you know, salivating at this point, will throw their 20% on. So your 30% increase, you go to 33, and then another 6% is, you know, you're up to 40%. And as scarcity starts to impact that, I can see short term your lumber package coming in at 50% more than you had anticipated it to even a month ago. Mm-hmm. And that's going to seriously impact affordability and just the, you know, ability to even put the stuff up. It's to say nothing of labor.
Yeah. So I know one of the major economic indicators is new home starts. So I imagine they're going to get hit, and then we're going to look at our economy as though it's waning.
Well, you know, my understanding was one of the pushes sort of nationwide is to get the housing stock up, catch up, you know, get these people into homes, you know, that there is apparently, at least if you believe any half of what you read, there's a conscientious effort to house, you know, to get into affordable housing, moderate income housing, that kind of thing. It's not going to happen. Right. You know, not without being heavily subsidized. You can't make it work.
Now, that's interesting. As we're having this conversation, I'm visualizing you sitting down with a potential owner and trying to project a project for next year. And, you know, obviously we can talk about who's going to take the risk of price increases, but at a minimum, they're going to want to say, okay, what are you looking at to budget for this project? How do you budget in this environment? And, you know, where are the big wild cards? We talked about lumber. What are some of the other things that are concerning you in terms of future-looking price uncertainty?
Well, the obvious one, Roger, is labor. You know, the construction industry depends heavily on immigrant labor. You know, there, I would say, and it's hard to say, you know, I'm not going to get into the, who's illegal, who's not, who has a work visa, who doesn't. The fact is we do. All right. You know, I would say 40% of the people that have worked for me over the past 32 years, 40 to 50% are immigrant labor. And so, you know, you take that equation out. What happens? Well, you have scarcity in labor. What does scarcity do? It drives up the cost. Labor costs never go back down. Okay. Once you hit a certain level, it stays there. I mean, commodity prices can go up and down depending on availability. Labor never goes down. And so, you know, and that's to say if you can even find the labor as you, you know, because, you know, this is hard work. I mean, to take the guys that probably are most impacted are the laborers. Okay, you know, I would challenge anybody to spend a day being a lumber monkey, and because you have your carpenters and the guys go and they bring their wood up to them all day long. They're hauling that wood off of the staging area up to the guy who's actually doing the work. All right, do 8-9 hours of that in a given day and go home and tell me how you feel. Mm-hmm. And, you know, after you've had your sixth Advil, you know, you will, you know, I mean, honestly, it's hard work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we're going to have to make that up with domestic labor, you know, based on the current policies that are going on and this just off the wall sense of outrage regarding it. And, so it's you know, there's no question in my mind that certainly as commodity prices go up, labor prices are going to be impacted by the new draconian immigration policies, because, you know, I think it's going to be difficult to even get work visas until this thing settles down.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to be dependent entirely on domestic labor.
Gotcha. Yeah. So we briefly looked at lumber coming in from Canada or Pacific Northwest or the South. Where does our steel come from? Does it still come from Pittsburgh?
No. I think that there's an argument that the United States should have some significant steel plants. We don't anymore,
yeah.
You know. And I mean, one of the largest ones was this one down here in Utah County. And, of course, now it's a great big subdivision. And so I forget what it was called. It was, anyway.
Right next to a Utah Lake?
Yeah. And so, but in any event, you know, the steel, which is very labor intensive, very difficult to produce, you know, lots of moving parts. And, you know, you throw in safety regulations and, you know, worker safety and all that kind of thing. And it became unprofitable to produce in the United States. Now, so where does it all come from? You know, there's different places. You know, China is a big part of it. Canada still has some steel mills. But it's a, you know, that's a tough one there. I mean, you know, we don't have at this point the capacity to make up our manufacturing base that was here even 20, 30 years ago. I mean, you're going to have a 2 or 3 year ramp up, you know, if you can find the commodities and the labor to produce it.
Yeah.
So it's it sort of this self-devolving circle.
So at this point, and for the next 2 or 3 years, we are dependent on imports.
No question.
Yeah. To keep the economy going, to keep housing starts. Yeah. Concrete, asphalt.
Those are, typically, well, asphalt is a function of the price of oil, always has been. It goes up, it goes down, you know, and but concrete and those kind of products are typically produced locally in smaller firms. So I don't see those being as impacted, except also with the labor component.
What about equipment? What about, you know, construction equipment, bulldozers and those kind, cranes, those kinds of things?
Well, you know, obviously the price of those will increase as the commodity prices, you know, if it's wildly fluctuating, people will always err on the side of what is my worst case scenario. And so you're going to pay more for that equipment. And, you know, there's no way around it. I mean, you can't wave a magic wand and have somebody pay these tariffs. You know, the Tooth Fairy's not going to pay them. And so what happens is it gets passed on to who? The end consumer, period.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's, you know, the manufacturer's not going to suddenly figure out a way to produce his equipment for 30% less. He can't. He has to pass that along. So that's where that ends up.
So where do you see all this going?
Oh, my gosh. You know, you just asked the question of the day, I guess. I think collectively as a citizenry of a country, we're all hoping there's actually a plan to all this. You know, I mean, it's right now it feels like chaos. And I'm not going to sit here and second guess what's being done or what's been done. I can tell you that everyone is pulling back right now. I mean, you're stupid to dive into this and expect it to normalize itself. I don't know when that's, you know, this chaotic period will extend for a period of time.
Yeah.
Big question is how long is that? So, you know, the whole thing's very troubling. You just hope that there is a plan in place and that they do have an idea about how this thing is going to shake out, because right now it sure doesn't feel that way. You know, my empirical observation, I will have to say that I would not start a large project right now.
Well, we just spent a few minutes with Rory Murphy, builder-developer here in Park City. What's the name of your company?
Well, the company I'm working with right now is the J. Fisher Company, we're doing the Homestake, it's on Homestake. It's the Engine House Project, yeah. Affordable Housing Project in Park City, but luckily all of our lumber's purchased.
And do you have any jobs down the road that you're looking at?
I have a couple I put on the shelf.
Okay.
Yeah. Did. So I'm, I'm not going to do anything until this thing settles down.
Right on. Well, with that uplifting news,
sorry.
We'll be right back after this.